Immigration is the lead today. No, not the story you're thinking of. Also, federal regulations and the undoing thereof. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The 7th of February, a Tuesday. Glad you're here, everybody. While the president's travel ban is in court this afternoon, a teleconference, more properly, there is another immigration proposal that is going to be getting some attention. A bill introduced today by Republican Senators Tom Cotton from Arkansas and Georgia's David Perdue would cut the number of immigrant visas by 40% in its first year, 50% over a decade. For some context here, the U.S. admits about a million immigrants every year. The bill is emphatically not about national security. The stated aim of the RAISE Act, that catchy acronym thing Congress does, for Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment Act, is to reduce the number of unskilled immigrants to the United States, immigrants who often do those jobs that American workers will not. So Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going by looking at what a legal immigration cutback would mean for this economy.
Nadine Hariri's family owns two Middle Eastern restaurants in Toledo, Ohio. Together, they employ about 40 workers.
The vast majority are immigrants. They play a key role to our success, especially in the kitchen and in the back.
The bill proposed by Republican Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue would limit the number of low-skilled immigrant workers. Workers who are often employed in construction, tourism, and restaurants like Hariri's. Here's Senator Cotton on MSNBC.
We're at record high levels of immigration in this country. I don't think our immigration system is working for working Americans.
Cotton's bill would favor immigrants coming in on employment-based visas and dramatically reduce green cards for adult relatives of U.S. citizens. It would also limit refugees to 50,000 a year. Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies. She says it's a good bill.
Our economy now is not creating enough jobs to employ even all of the people who are here as Americans, much less a million new immigrants per year.
Raul Inhosa, a professor and immigration expert at UCLA, sees things differently.
They make jobs. Immigrants make jobs for the rest of us. Without immigration, the U.S. population and economy would be shrinking.
He says immigrants who are not yet citizens contribute more than $3 trillion to the U.S. economy.
This is a huge, huge contribution. That's bigger than most economies in the world.
And Jose says that will surely be part of the argument as the bill moves through Congress. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
From Detroit this morning, quite the set of numbers for General Motors. Record earnings of $12.5 billion last year. The company's 52,000 hourly workers are going to take home profit-sharing checks of as much as $12,000. All the more impressive when one considers where the company was less than a decade ago, bailed out by the American taxpayer. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports now on what the future might hold.
It's been heady times for GM, with this being the fourth consecutive year of record sales, and that success is for two big reasons: huge demand in the domestic market as well as abroad, particularly in China.
Between those two markets, they're accounting for 37 million of the 90 million vehicles sold in the world.
Rebecca Lindlin is an analyst with Cox Automotive. She says U.S. car buyers still can't get enough of the high-margin trucks and SUVs, and the same thing is happening in China.
So if those markets are aligned, it helps an awful lot with profitability for the manufacturers.
Lindlin says GM now sells more cars in China than the U.S., but unlike years past, the major car makers aren't resting on their laurels. Case in point, rival Ford. Its Super Bowl ad was chock full of references to things like ride shares, bike shares, and electric vehicles.
That's why Ford is developing new ways to help you move through life.
Legacy automakers are bracing for a future where they sell less cars. Ford has invested in the shuttle van startup Chariot, while GM has taken a $500 million stake in Lyft. Jessica Caldwell is an analyst for Edmunds.
The fact that a lot of tech companies are trying to jump into the auto space and everybody wants to disrupt, whether it's dealerships or auto industry, I think it's made auto companies a bit more competitive.
While carmakers might be keeping a close eye on Silicon Valley, Caldwell says she doesn't expect people to give up their cars and trucks anytime soon, especially if gas prices continue to remain cheap. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The acting head of the Securities and Exchange Commission has some thoughts on CEO pay, specifically the part of the post-crisis Dodd-Frank law that says, and here I quote, "It requires a public company to disclose the ratio of the compensation of its chief executive officer to the median compensation of its employees," end of quote. We learned this week that the SEC is going to reconsider implementation of that rule. So Marketplace's Brie Benishore took to the streets of New York to find out what workers think about what their bosses make.
There are a lot of ways you can look at how much your big boss makes compared to you. One is the resigned approach.
I do a job. They do a job. Yeah. You make what you make.
So, no, it doesn't matter to me. I expect that my boss will make significantly much more, especially in a profession I'm in, which is teaching. So.
You should be compensated for your seniority and your skill set.
Justin Fry, Joy Edwards, Neil Ard. Then there are the people who see their boss's pay as aspirational.
Being a boss is working your way up, so maybe if you work as hard as they did, you'll actually get into a position that they're in to make the amount of money that they make.
And maybe it'll motivate you a little bit more.
Dave McRae was let Claude optimists. Knowing your boss's pay could certainly motivate you, could also motivate you to be really annoyed.
They really don't do anything. The amount of work that they're employees put in is a lot more than what the CEO does anyway. The only thing that does, I appreciate what they do, is opening a company and they're running the company. But based on the workload, their associates do most of the work.
So I think there should be some equal portion between what the bottom rank makes and what the senior group makes.
Leo Lawrence, Ed Hamill. If you work for a publicly traded company, you can likely look up the ratio of what your boss makes compared to workers in any annual reports issued in the last 6 weeks. Whether you feel encouraged or neutral or resentful, that's all up to you. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today started strong, finished less strong. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While the appeals court takes up President Trump's travel ban, it is worth mentioning here that so far the White House has issued 22 executive actions, one of which last week was a two-for-one deal. Two federal regulations repealed for every new one issued. To get a better handle on what it's going to take for the White House to get to that goal, we asked Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein to look at what goes into finalizing a rule and what it takes to undo one.
Rulemaking is serious business, but Sean Moulton with the Project on Government Oversight says it never seems to get the kind of love it deserves.
Yeah, I know laws really get all the attention. They're sexy. Everyone wants to cheer about getting a law signed by the president. But the reality is regulations are where the rubber meets the road.
Moulton says usually laws aren't specific enough to be automatically enforced, so federal agencies have to turn statutory language into something usable. Those are the regulations. President Trump's order will only apply to major regulations. There are about 60 to 80 of those in a given year. Things like energy efficiency standards for microwaves and preventing salmonella in eggs. The rulemaking process is long and is tedious, filled with public notices, interagency reviews, and often thousands and thousands of pages of documents.
I'm the guy who sits in a room and nerds out on this stuff, reading this stuff for hours on end to make sense of it.
Adam Ekman, a lawyer with the National Mining Association, spent most of the past 2+ years working against the Stream Protection Rule, a rule aimed at protecting water bodies and wildlife from surface mining. The industry argued it would devastate coal companies, and for 7 years, the two sides battled back and forth. And meetings, oh, the dense, weedy meetings.
Just a tweak of language, the placement of a comma, can drastically change the requirements on the ground at a mine site. And we spent hours debating those finer points.
Finally, the rule took effect in January. About 10 days later, the House and Senate voted to rescind it. It just needs the president's signature to be gone for good. See, some regs are easier to roll back than others. Anything the Obama administration passed in its final 6 months, like the Stream Rule, only needs a simple majority in Congress, says Susan Dudley, the regulatory czar under George W. Bush.
I would expect at least a half a dozen regulations to be captured by that.
For major regulations that have been around for more than 6 months, like Dodd-Frank, which is already a target, they'll have to go through the whole process again. Cost-benefit reports, public comments, and yes, lots of meetings. The whole point is to dissuade new administrations from coming in and changing the rules businesses play by. And that, says Susan Dudley, is why old regulations won't go quietly.
People will litigate because once a regulation is in effect, those who have already complied with it, they're not going to want to see it just, oh, never mind, let's remove that.
But even as President Trump looks to shrink government, it's going to take government to rescind all of those regulations. The lesson is that eliminating a regulation takes as much time as creating one. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Today being Tuesday, there's another episode of Make Me Smart dropping into your feeds this afternoon. Our new podcast, Molly Wood and Me, on the news of the week. Some guests sometimes, but also your questions. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so here is today's question from a listener smack dab in your wheelhouse. His name is Dave Warner in Georgia, and he wants to know this. Is Amazon a job killer?
I know. I thought that was such a fascinating question because it's one of those questions where the more I thought about it, the more answers there were. Because it's really complicated, right? On the one hand, is Amazon a job killer? Well, it's moving quickly in the direction of automation. Mm-hmm. It's going to have drones do delivery. It's slurping up other businesses at an alarming rate and putting other businesses out of business. So in that sense, yes, you could consider Amazon a job killer. On the other hand, itself, the company has said we're going to add 100,000 full-time jobs in the U.S. by mid-2018. It already employs 300,000, and it enables businesses, I think, around it. It creates an ecosystem of business that could create more jobs, too.
Is it proper, though, to credit Amazon for those? Because, you know, it's not Jeff Bezos, while he does all kinds of nice things with his money, is a cutthroat businessman who wants to, and this is my opinion, take over the world, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we are rapid. So I think on the one hand, there are other ways in which Amazon enables business. And one of those ways is AWS. It's sort of enterprise services.
The cloud stuff, right?
The cloud stuff. Right. Yeah. Like you can build a startup with five people for using Amazon's cloud services for all of your hosting and have it be cheaper than it ever could have been in the past. Like there are literally startups today that exist because they have the access to those cloud services. And for a while, Amazon was providing free access to startups under a certain size. So if you look at that kind of halo effect of the businesses that are created as a result of those services that Amazon provides, then you could argue that it's a huge job creator. Now, but the downside of it is we are rapidly, and I'm not making this up, we are rapidly heading in the direction where there is basically nothing that you do, right, online or in your digital life that doesn't touch Amazon in some way. Right. And that is a big deal.
And that is a big deal because it's not like they're going to turn the switch off, but we then become captive to their capitalist whims, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Or to whether they have outages, right? We become captive. I mean, if you look at the last time that AWS went down, the Amazon Web Services framework went down, took down Twitter, took down the New York Times. It is a huge dependency, and it is certainly, and President Trump has suggested this in the past, something to look at in terms of competition.
This is, just to get all macro here for a second, it's another sign of the changing economy, right? It's that idea that by offering, you know, cloud services, for instance, it can create the jobs, but then it comes with a whole bunch of downsides and different kinds of jobs go away.
Yeah, exactly. So if the question only is Amazon a job killer? I would say no. Is Amazon a competition killer long term? Is Amazon the company that in the sci-fi future is the one that runs the entire world? That's the real question.
That and so much more on the podcast. It is called Make Me Smart. Molly Wood and me and you, actually. Molly, tell them how to get a hold of us.
We have a new episode out today, actually, which you can find at marketplace.org/makemesmart or download it in your podcatcher of choice. If you're using iTunes, I only have one request if you like it, or even if you don't, leave us a review.
Be kind, please. We'll be right back. Coming up.
In Berlin, we have the entrepreneur DNA in our blood.
Berlin and Brooklyn, partners across the sea. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 37 points today, about a tenth percent, 20,090 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 10 points, about a tenth percent, 5674. S&P 500 basically flat, 2293. Tech did all right. Apple brightened almost 1%. IBM up 1.5%. Google parent Alphabet advanced 0.9% today. In other results, Emerson Electric sparked up 4.4% today after posting better-than-expected earnings and sales. Health insurer Centene rallied 5.3% on higher quarterly revenue and profit. Michael Kors, however, down 10.8%. The high-end accessories chain posted lower third-quarter earnings. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back in 2010, during the last census, Reading, Pennsylvania had the highest poverty rate in the country for cities with populations of 65,000 or more, almost 42% of the population. While Reading has seen its share of industrial decline, factories closing, and jobs moving to Mexico, the manufacturing industry in town is fairly stable these days. But with a quarter of the manufacturing workforce in the area set to retire in the next 10 years, employers and educators are working on a new pipeline of younger workers with advanced skills to fill those jobs. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In a lab at Reading Area Community College, 18-year-old Benjamin Eckenrode stands in front of a blue wall rigged with pistons, pumps, and gauges, parts of machinery he might find on a factory floor.
This piston is supposed to go down and actually pick up the ball, but it is not.
Eckenrode's assignment is to figure out why the piston isn't moving. The high school senior is taking this college class as part of a program to prepare more young people for careers in the technical trades. Bonnie Spade directs the Schmidt Technology and Training Center at the college. She says it's still possible to get an entry-level factory job with just a diploma, paying maybe $17 an hour. But with a little extra training, make that $20 to $30 an hour. Plus benefits.
The good news for you, if you're not employed and you want to get employed, pretty much the world's your oyster. I mean, if you're paying attention in here, and I've done my job well to make sure this is a good fit for you, you're probably looking at 4 or 5 different job offers.
That's probably not the story you've heard about Reading, in many ways a typical Rust Belt town. Since 2001, it's lost nearly 8,000 manufacturing jobs, about 20%.
There's a lot of bad press out there. You know, a lot of large companies that have closed.
Ken Krause is CEO of U.S. Axle, a nearly 100-year-old company that makes components for locomotives and large construction equipment. He says the manufacturing sector has stabilized in recent years. Some 500 companies in the county make anything from batteries to chocolate to surgical needles. But Krauss says the stigma against manufacturing has stuck, and the workforce hasn't kept up to fill the increasingly technical jobs.
We're probably 10 years behind where we need to be in terms of training and making sure that we have a mature pipeline, and that's where these sorts of programs come into play.
The Schmidt Center was founded about 10 years ago to partner with employers and local high schools to build that pipeline. Manufacturers are also competing with college. Terry Baller is the work-based learning coordinator at Reading Muhlenberg Career and Technology Center. She says students have heard their entire lives that they have to get a four-year degree.
When you walk into the classroom and you ask how many kids are going to college, they all raise their hand. So they haven't even really thought about any other options.
In Reading, one of those options is East Penn Manufacturing, a huge complex in the hills outside the city that employs more than 7,000 people making batteries for cars, motorcycles, and data centers. 39-year-old Joe Ritzko started on the production line 10 years ago with just a high school diploma. Then the company sent him to Reading Area Community College for additional technical training. Now he's a maintenance mechanic making more than $26 an hour.
I really honestly couldn't be happier. I'm home every night. I make a good wage. I am able to do something that my parents were not able to do, and that's at least give my kids something if something would ever happen to me, or provide them with a good future.
Ritzko's dad worked for a steel plant that moved to Mexico after NAFTA. President Trump's campaign message of bringing back those jobs resonated in Reading. The typically blue county went red this time. Employers say their challenge is training enough workers for the jobs that are already here. In Reading, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
While the fate of the European Union, if not actually hanging in the balance, then certainly more confused than it used to be, what with Brexit and Greece in the throes of yet another debt crisis, actually the same Greek debt crisis, just extended, Berlin, Germany, is on the lookout for ways to attract businesses and jobs. Good thing for Berliners, then, that Brooklyn, New York, is looking for the same thing. The two cities have a partnership going, trying to drive growth and innovation by connecting their emerging startup scenes. Marketplace's Mark Garrison paid both places a visit to see what it's all about.
Berlin wants the world's startups. Stefan Franschke is charged with reeling them in.
In Berlin, we have the entrepreneur DNA in our blood.
He's CEO of Berlin Partner, the public-private organization that pitches businesses large and small on moving here. His pitch is this: there's great talent, cheap real estate, and everyone speaks English. Post-Brexit, he's been stressing access to the European market and a warm welcome for foreign workers. And of course, there are the cultural attractions.
For young people, Berlin nightlife, it's really amazing. We have galleries, we have a cultural life.
Right now, the city is hungry enough for foreign startups that it's rolling out a red carpet offer. Entrepreneurs from four global locations, including Brooklyn, can get access to free office space, and Berlin Partner will connect them with potential customers, partners, and investors. Sometimes they even set them up with airfare.
My name is Jake Levin. I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
Recently taking Berlin's offer, Shared Studios, where Jake Levin is chief of staff. The company makes giant immersive spaces where people around the world can see and talk to each other on massive screens. Levin spent about 3 weeks in Berlin and came away impressed. Shared Studios is considering Berlin as its first overseas office.
While I was there, we actually hired two people. Both are actually Syrian refugees. And so I can say very confidently that it was valuable in terms of job creation, in terms of professional connections, and in terms of connecting with people who are potentially going to be able to help us expand our network.
The Startup Exchange works for Berlin companies as well. That's the sound of a row of 3D printers steadily making furniture and parts right in front of us. The printer is made by Big Rep, and we're now in their Berlin headquarters. CFO Stefan Bayer shows off a finished piece. 3D printing is a hot field, and as the company grew, it was looking to set up a North American base.
The obvious choice would have been going to Silicon Valley.
But he sees the Valley as more of a software community, not the best fit for his hardware company. Plus, an East Coast time zone is preferable.
Through a contract from Berlin Partners, we got introduced to our friends at NewLab in Brooklyn. And, you know, I looked at the website and said, hey, this is the place for us. This is just perfect.
And that place is where we go next.
We're here at New Lab in the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Dunya DuPont is New Lab's chief operating officer.
I'm standing here looking at the dry dock where the ships were built and assembled. And
it's a cavernous warehouse the size of a major arena. Tens of thousands once built ships here through World War II and beyond. But the Pentagon closed up shop in 1966 and the yard hit hard times. New Lab is a recent development, an attempt to build a new kind of high-tech industry around startups. When Berlin Partner was looking for an American counterpart, DuPont says things just clicked.
Berlin's passion and scrappiness is something that we feel is so important to us here in Brooklyn as well. And so we meet on that same playing field, and we're able to relate in terms of how our companies are coming together to grow.
That collaboration is not even a year old, so it's too soon to know what kind of impact it could have. But there's optimism in both places. Big Rep plans to keep hiring in Brooklyn, possibly adding dozens of new positions. Brooklyn and Berlin both spent decades as underdogs before the latest revival. This unusual partnership is a bet that their entrepreneurs have something to teach each other about rising even higher. In Berlin, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, no, it's not just you. A survey commissioned by BetterWorks, that's a software company up in Silicon Valley, it shows workers are spending an average of 2 hours a day reading political social media posts. Almost half of people say they have seen a political conversation turn into an argument at work, and almost 30% of workers say they are less productive since the election. Of course, that could mean that 70% of people say they are more productive since the election too, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 37 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 10 points, also a 10%. S&P 500 basically flat. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.